typical example of fitting all your priorities in. Because people often say to me, I just don't know how I can fit everything in my life. You know, I need about another 2 to 4 hours a day to fit it in. So I've got this this one-pint jug, and this one-pint glass is, represents the capacity of my life. Okay, this is the 168 hours a week I have available to me in the 7 days. And here I have half a dozen eggs. These eggs represent my priorities. I guarantee they're not hard-boiled here, Nicola. They're rubber. So now then, tell me what's your biggest in time terms? What's your biggest priority?
Work.
No. Who said sleep? Sleep. That's the one. If you don't sleep, eventually you're gonna, you know, die probably. Okay, what's your next priority after sleep? You've got to keep yourself well, haven't you? You've got to be able to eat, you know, to wash, to exercise, to rest appropriately. So you need all that stuff for your own personal wellness. Then you get not work. What's your next priority? Your relationships. All your key relationships, your family, your friends, your colleagues. That has to fit in. And then, of course, comes your work. And as the gentleman over there has already pointed out, most people think of work first. So they have an Easter egg-sized egg for work and nothing else fits in. And then finally, I've got one more egg that will just go in, and I'm going to call that margin. Margin is everything that's going to happen to you that you don't know about yet, but it is going to happen, okay? So there's my key priorities in my jar. And now I have a series of marbles. And these marbles represent the things I would like to do, you know. So some of my interests and hobbies, some of those things that I particularly want to do in life. Because I have a degree in chemistry, I can tell you these marbles are flowing around the interstitial spaces between the eggs. And you can actually fit in quite a lot of what you want to do on top of what you must do in your jar, okay? So I've fitted in a whole load of marbles. And then I've got sand. Sand represents the time that I waste, okay? Playing a stupid computer game, watching an unnecessary television program, just staring at the horizon, dreaming, wishing I was retired. Yeah, and so it goes on. You know, you can pour quite a bit of sand in and still have your life full. So what's the problem, you say? Well, if I tip all this out and just reassemble my materials here, if I put into the jar the sand first, I'll have to do this carefully so as not to wreck the stage, but if I put in the time I waste first and all the things I would like to do first, you don't have to be a genius to figure out that when I come to put the eggs in, it's not going to work. You know, I can put in 1, 2, 3 eggs, and now I've got 2 eggs that I can't fit in. So I'm going to lose all my margin, and I'm either not going to get enough sleep, or I'm not going to complete my work, or I'm not going to see my family, or I'm not going to take care of myself. Okay? And that is the 2 to 4 hours a day that I talked about, that everybody needs extra. The learning is, when you're planning, when you've got your acres of space in your diary for the time ahead, put your eggs in first. Don't just put your work commitments in, put the time in that you need for these other key things, for relationships, for sleep, for wellness, for exercise, and then you can fit other things around it. Okay? Very simple, but I find that's helped a lot of people. And I often say, get your eggs in first. Yes, sir.
Sorry, Paul, you've missed one bit on your first part of the allegory.
And yeah.
And that is beer. There's always room for beer.
There is room for beer. It just makes a hell of a mess in the glass. So get your eggs in first and don't lose your marbles. Thank you. Okay, let me move on to my own work and life. Now, this part of my presentation really has two elements. It's my own personal story, which I recognise is completely unlike your story. I mean, I'm now, you know, a white 60-something ex-corporate director with a beard that's gone white, and, you know, you are totally different to that. But I'm hoping that through the process of reflecting on my own life, I will be able to draw out some key principles, some key choices that you will think, ah, yeah, I can take that as a nugget that applies to my life in perhaps a different context. That's what I'm trying to do. So, I'm going to tackle this in decades. I'm not going to deal with the first two decades, and I'm not saying they're not significant, because actually some quite formative things can happen to you in your first couple of decades of life, but it's typically when you get to your 20s that you first get full-time work. So I'm going to start with my 20s. And this is more about discerning God through reflection, I would say, rather than a bolt from the blue. So 20 to 30, foundational choices. So I took a degree in chemistry, decided that I was then going to be a commercial manager and not a chemist after all. That's a sudden change of direction. So I got a job with Unilever as a commercial management trainee, and I qualified as an accountant. So I used to be an accountant, but I'm all right now. I worked first of all at Walls Ice Cream Limited in Gloucestershire. What a great company to work for. That. If I was there now, I'd be dead. I tell you, the amount of free ice cream available. I married my lovely wife, Helen, who I met at Bristol, where we were both doing degrees. And we had our first child, Matt, when we were, 27? Something like that. And that triggered a coming back to faith for us. I was, I think, a nominal Christian up until that point. I had been confirmed, but just drifted away in my teens, didn't have a Christian friends, more or less forgot about it, but retained a kind of basic faith. Helen didn't know the Lord at that time, but when we had our son baptized or christened, it starts to trigger questions in your mind. Well, why am I doing this? What am I going to teach this child? And so on. And that led us, after we'd relocated to Berkshire when I changed to my job with Hewlett-Packard, led us to a church where we heard the gospel, and I recommitted my life to Christ, and Helen came to faith. At the same time, we were baptized together by immersion, weren't we? Aged 31. So at the end of that decade, I discovered that I am blessed, and that's great. Now, as I moved on into my 30s, I would say the balance of my life, the direction of my life, began to change from what I call survival to significance. Now, by survival, I mean that, you know, when I was young, I wanted a car, I wanted a house, I wanted a job, I wanted a family, you know, the sort of basics of, if you like, the foundational blocks of life. When you've got those things, you then start looking for something else. You start looking for that stuff that I was on about earlier. Self-worth, success, achievement. I had in common with many 30-something men a drive to succeed, a drive to make a mark in the world, to be recognised. And it was about feeding my own self-worth through that cycle of grief that I was talking about earlier. So I became general manager for a small leasing company that Hewlett-Packard owned. By 35, I'd become the European general manager for that leasing business, and age 40, I became the finance director for Hewlett-Packard in the UK. And but this promotion and this recognition came at a cost, and a lot of the cost is sitting on the front row there, as you can tell you. You know, it's quite a painful thing to reflect on, actually, for us, and particularly for Helen. I was working 10 hours a day, probably frequent international travel, took me away from home. Hewlett-Packard's European headquarters is in Geneva. I've flown to Geneva 150 times, probably. The global headquarters is in San Francisco. I've spent 3 months of my life in San Francisco in five-day hops for global meetings. You know, if you've heard of that book, The Five Love Languages, have you come across that? The five ways in which people give and receive love: words, time, gifts, acts of service, and touch. One of our important love languages, one of Helen's important love languages, is time, not the only one. So you can imagine what this kind of profile was doing to our marriage. It was introducing stress caused by excess busyness and my focus on achievement at the cost of relational health. Nevertheless, God was still blessing us, both financially and with a second child, David, who was conceived in response to prayer. And I began to take retreats and to set aside time to seek God. So at the end of this decade, I would say that I discovered I'm a big boy now, and boy am I stressed. That's sort of the end of what I call the warrior phase. I don't know if you've heard this term, quiet desperation. There's a lot of it about. You know, time, in a way, is a kind of negative status symbol, isn't it? If you're incredibly busy and you've got no time, you must be incredibly important. So busy people are sort of, oh yes, they're important. But, and I was probably very successful in that way of looking at the world. But underlying a lot of stress. The stress of relationships, the stress of overwork, the stress of realising that something would have to give eventually. I could not go on indefinitely in that way, at that pace. So I've looked back over this warrior phase, and I've reflected on the life choices I made, and I've listed some good choices and some bad choices. But just before I show you that, I'm going to show you a short video clip from the adverts in the American Super Bowl a few years ago about a guy who works in an office called Terry Tate. And here it is.
Yes, Reebok descendants Terry Tate. Some people thought we were crazy. But I'm a firm believer in paradigm breaking, outside the box thinking.
Anyway. Wait, it's over! 15 seconds ago! Mitch!
And since Terry's been with us, our productivity has gone up 46%. We're getting more from our employees than ever before.
You know you need a cover sheet or your KPS report, Richard! That ain't you, baby! Hey, Janet!
What's really impressed me is how Terry's become part of the Felcher family.
That's a little bit small, Doug!
To be honest, I wish Reebok sent us 10 Terry Tates.
Woman, it's getting time! It's paying time, baby!
Terry Tate, office linebacker. There's always some linebacker on your case, isn't there, really? And part of the driven culture. Anyway, here's some good choices and bad choices I thought I made in that decade. First of all, the good choices. Well, I did openly identify myself as a Christian. I was sufficiently secure to do that. I used to wear a fish badge on my lapel of my suit and so on. And that has some interesting effects in the workplace, doesn't it? I don't know what it's like in the military, but in business, I happen to be in a lift in the headquarters of HSBC Bank in a place called Poultry in London. I was going up in this rather small lift to a boardroom meeting, and there was this guy in the lift with me who saw my fish badge and gave what I can only describe as an undisguised sneer. Sort of socially awkward moment in a confined space, you know. On the other hand, my boss, who was called Craig, would call these San Francisco global meetings on Monday morning at 9 o'clock, and you can't get in your car in Berkshire and drive to a meeting in San Francisco. You have to get on a plane on Sunday morning. And I said to him one day, you know, Craig, I'm a Christian. I like to be in church on Sunday with my family. Any chance we could start these meetings on Tuesday? And he said, oh, I don't know about that. I've got people coming from Asia Pacific on the opposite time zone. So I just left it. Next time he announced it, Tuesday. Yeah. Sometimes pays to be open, doesn't it? That made a difference. I think I accepted the right jobs. I always prayed about jobs, but I found it very difficult to pray about promotions because I always had mixed motives. You know, you want to be promoted, and on the other hand, you think, well, maybe I shouldn't want to be promoted. So I used to pray that God would block my promotion if it was the wrong thing. And I think he allowed me into the right jobs. That was the only way I could deal with my mixed motives. I actually refused a relocation to Geneva as a non-negotiable. They offered me some position in Geneva, and Helen and I didn't want to move there. We were established in a local church. Our kids were at school. You know, we had a great geographic situation. So I said no, which was sort of awkward. You know, if you say no to a promotion, that gets noticed. But it was a good choice, which my family really appreciated. I did these retreats. I spent retreats with God. I spent on these days away. I didn't have that much annual leave. But Helen said, I was so much easier to live with when I came back from a retreat, she didn't mind me taking a day's annual leave to do it. So that was a bit of a lifeline for me, actually, to get away from the treadmill and to reflect on things, something we don't often do in this very intense, busy world. During a time of prayer and fasting, I heard a call to preach and speak, and I pursued it. And I also felt a call to stay in the church and lead, which I describe in my book. So these were some of the good choices. Now here are some of the bad choices. I did not pray about everything I did, all the activities I undertook, and so in Christian jargon I did a lot of uncommanded work. You know, work that was probably feeding my cycle of grief, my temporary acceptance. So that was a mistake. I allowed my own insecurity and my ego to drive me into workaholism for success, like a lot of people, I think. And, I still have to fight against that sometimes. I paid insufficient attention to Helen and other key family relationships because I was so maxed out in my job. And I became what is referred to as a plate spinner, you know, where you've got all these different things that you're trying to keep going, and in the end one of them's going to fall over. And I ate too much. Comfort eating, I think, in the face of stress, you know, it gets to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you need a Mars bar or whatever, you know. So I started putting on a bit of weight because I wasn't exercising enough and because I was maxed out. So those are some of my bad choices in that decade. Then I got older. I'd committed my life to Christ. I'd understood more about the importance of the gospel, and I found a different set of values started to come through in my life. As a Christian, I began to reflect more on why I was here on planet Earth. You know, what was I here for? What is my calling? What is my purpose, really? I wanted to make a difference in the long run, not just in the temporary short term. So as I enter my 40s, I discern this shift in the prime focus of my life, away from pursuing success and self-worth, more towards pursuing significance and service. So that underlying driver changed. And I think that for anybody at any stage in your life, one of these three circles probably dominates your behavior. It affects your general approach to life. Survival, success, or significance. I wonder which of them is driving you now. I mean, I've known guys who have been in their 60s who have still got their nose to the grindstone because they're worried about the size of their pension. You know, that's actually living in survival mode, even though you're older. So quite an interesting question to ask yourself, because it's your personal values that really determine which of those is driving you. And your values determine your destiny in the end. I read a book by a guy called Bob Buford called Half Time, which really challenged me to understand and define my personal values. I don't know if you've ever tried writing down what your values are. It's quite an interesting exercise. I mean, you can write down things like the Apostles' Creed and whatever, but what are your own personal values? What is it that's really important to you? Because I became more and more convinced that living an integrated life depended on me understanding that, and those values permeating every aspect of what I did. And so having about 1,000 people in my organisation, I found myself increasingly coaching others about their career, their life choices, and people seemed to be coming to me for advice. And I ran a series of career conferences and I showed this slide: integrity is consistently living your values. Okay, that's what integrity is. It's knowing your values and living them, walking the talk, I guess. Now, as I turned 40, we'd lost our minister at church, as I mentioned earlier, and I was asked to preach then and developed a preaching and teaching ministry in response to that, and which God had told me about beforehand. And my 40s was really a time of radical reappraisal. And I started working on a life purpose and mission statement, which I'll share with you later. But I began to think about these issues of core values and purpose. But of course, this was also the time when I experienced maximum work-life stress because my brother got ill, you know, the minister had gone, and all that stuff was happening. And so Helen and I eventually went on a marriage encounter weekend, which was excellent, probably saved our marriage, or at least helped a lot. I began to think about how I could change where I was at. And I was at a service in London called Midweek in Mayfair. And I was sitting in the back row with a friend of mine called Stuart. And at the end of the service, I was chatting with him, and Stuart said to me, "Why don't you ask him for a four-day week?" I said, "You're out of your mind, Stuart. Finance directors are lucky if they work 6 days a week, never mind about four." "Oh, it's just a thought," he said. So shortly after that, I was at this career conference where I showed this slide, integrity is consistently living your values, and my car was stolen. And this was in Birmingham. And I had to go straight from this conference to Geneva with my boss, you know, Clouseau. So that meant he and I would share a car from Birmingham to Heathrow. 2 hours in the car with Clouseau. And, you know, we started chatting, as you do. And I guess he must have got the impression that something was going to have to give in the way that, you know, I was talking about what was happening to me. And after a long pause, he said, "Well, Paul," he said, "I don't want to lose you. Why don't you work a four-day week?" At which point, I thought it was God saying, going, "Buy a four-day week!" And he said, I can't keep up the accent, he said, "Try an experiment. Try an experiment where you work 4 days or 80% of your normal pattern. You'll have to remain accessible on the telephone because you're an escalation point for some key processes, but you don't have to be physically in the office." So I said, "Okay, fine." He said, "Don't tell anybody about this except me and your secretary." Now, because I was often away from my desk, it wasn't unusual for me not to be there. So so I started this 3 months experiment. He said, "You can do this on full pay for 3 months and then report back." So at the end of 3 months, I wrote an email to all my key staff, my key clients, whatever, you know, all the people I interacted with. And I said, "Have you noticed anything different about my working pattern or my output during this last 3 months?" And I started getting replies back. "No, no, no, no." So I got on a plane to see Clouseau, and I walked into his office in Geneva, and I said, "Nobody notices any difference." "Neither did I," he said. "I knew it," he said. "I knew you never did any work at all." So he said, "Do you want to do it?" I said, "Yeah, okay." He said, "Okay, 80% base pay, 80%, you know, working hours. You manage it, maintain the performance like it is, that's fine. And I worked like that for another 5 years, during which time I was actually promoted to take over a different responsibility." It's interesting, isn't it, how you think you're locked in to a certain pattern. I heard how the Bee Gees pop group got started. You know, the Gibb brothers, Maurice Gibb and his lot. They used to have these discs that they would sing karaoke to in Manchester theatres, and they would put on their disc, you know, get their mics, and they'd start singing. And one day, just before they went on, they accidentally smashed their record. And they were like, "Oh, our whole act depends on this backing track. We'll just have to wing it. We'll have to sing in harmony." And immediately, they discovered the Bee Gees. Now, some patterns in work and in life are just like that backing track. You see, you're singing that song, you're singing that same thing, and you don't think you can do anything different until somebody smashes the record. You see, we can do sometimes things that we don't think are possible. It is possible to change things. So I began to think about this this whole issue of values, and I discovered it was time to be who God made me to be. I wish I'd discovered that earlier, but I did discover it then. These are some of the good choices I think I made during that period. I wrote a personal mission statement. I'll share that with you in a minute. And I paid off my mortgage early. Now, I realised that in the job that I had, I was incredibly privileged materially. And I know that that option is not available to a lot of people. The point is, though, that all my peers, all my fellow directors, were trading up. Bigger houses, bigger cars, Jaguars, all that stuff. and I did not do that. So I resisted the materially driven choices in life, and we chose to pay off the mortgage early instead, which I think was a good choice. I did marriage encounter with my lovely wife. I agreed a four-day week with my employer. I became a mentor for other people, and I recognized God's guidance to leave my job, which didn't happen immediately. I became finance director on the 25th of February 1994. And during the 1990s, I was reminded about that dream of Pharaoh. You know, the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine with Egypt and the grain. And I had several reminders of this from the Word, and then, you know, several other sort of prophetic kinds of inputs, including one Sunday when we had a visiting family who they sent their kids into our Sunday school, and when they came out, for some reason, he ran over and gave me the picture. And I kind of opened this picture, and it's seven fat cows and seven thin cows. And I'm thinking, why am I getting this? So I started thinking about how this might apply to my situation. And I came to the conclusion that my 7 years of economic plenty probably began when I joined the main board of HP. Salary goes up, stock and shares in the company, and all that kind of thing. And so I just made this mental note. Well, you know, 7 years from 1994 would be February 2001. And I parked that thought. And then in 1999, Hewlett-Packard announced the spin-off of a large part of its business called Agilent Technologies. And I was asked to be the transition manager and to peel apart the UK company into two and to create a two-company infrastructures to allow this spin-off to happen on a four-day week. And rather foolishly, I agreed to do this. And then I didn't realise that they gave me another big block of shares, golden handcuffs. And they said, you can have these shares, but you can't sell them until the end of the millennium after the spin-off to keep me in post. And I thought, when I reflected on it, I thought, that's really odd. You know, I've just received another bucket load of economic plenty with a specific time limit on it that exactly matches the end of 7 years from when I joined the board. And so I became increasingly interested in the thought that perhaps there was something about this. And I went on a retreat, and I just felt a complete peace that I should leave the company. I didn't have another job to go to, but just felt that it was time to leave. So I put my resignation letter in, 7 years to the day of being appointed. And that was strategically the right thing to do. Actually, tactically, I'd made a mistake, because I had 3 months' notice. So they didn't actually finish my employment until May 2001, not February 2001. And there was something called the dot-com bubble about then, you know, where shares had peaked. And between February 2001 and May 2001, the value of my stock options collapsed by £100,000 on the back of the collapse of the dot-com bubble. So which just goes to show, when God gives you a timing, do what he says. Now, £100,000 at minus capital gains tax of 40% is £60,000, and I probably earned another £20,000 during that time. So I only lost £40,000 in that 3 months period. But afterwards, I told Helen about it. I said I thought I'd made a mistake. I should have put my resignation in November and actually left in February. And then there was it was like a kind of slap on the wrist, really, from God. Then there was a change in the tax law, and the Inland Revenue lost a case called Mansworth v. Jelly, in which it affected the retrospective taxation of stock options, and I got a tax refund of £36,000, which, as somebody has pointed out, was the £40,000 I lost at minus God's 10%. Now, I don't know whether what your theology of guidance is, and I've written about that in the book Get a Life, but, you know, my theology of guidance is the Word first, conviction by the Spirit, and then the agreement of the wider body of believers. That's where we get our sanity check. Not that the wider body of believers is always right, but I think we should take our cue from the Word of God, the Spirit of God, and the support of the wider body. So those were the good choices. Here were the bad choices. I accepted on the telephone that double hat big responsibility to do that spin-off without praying. Idiot. I became physically present and emotionally absent. The ladies will know what that means. I became so busy that even when I was there, I was not there. You know, I don't know if you've ever been like that. I continued to eat too much, and I ignored my stress until I got a heart problem after I'd left Hewlett-Packard, aged 48. So that was the payoff for not getting it right during those busy years, probably. So here's a bit of a reflection I just invite you to do on the back of your piece of paper or one of your bits of paper. Have you all got the second bit of paper? Perhaps you haven't. Who hasn't got the other bit of paper? Which is the dominant driving force for you at the moment in your behaviour? Survival, success or significance? It's not on there, is it? You got some extra ones, did you? Who hasn't got a sheet? A couple at the back. There's one over there. I mean, you don't necessarily need a sheet for this anyway. That's the end of a sheet, not the one now. It's usually on the back of it. Well, you don't need the sheet if you haven't got it, because you can write it down anyway. But just think about which is it that's driving you at the minute? Survival, success or significance? What about thinking about some of the good choices and the bad choices you've made so far? Just look back and think about some of those. And has God highlighted something or convicted you of something during this session so far? Just give you a few minutes to think about that. When you've done it, have a brief chat with your neighbour. Okay, well let's move on again now, otherwise I'll run out of time. And there's a few other questions on the sheet which assume a longer time for reflection, but you can do those another time. So I'm just going to extract now from that story seven choices that I think are generally applicable to anyone. Now, I'm not trying to pretend when I say this that you can choose your way out of every problem in life, because you can't. You know, some choices that I identify, you genuinely may not be able to take. But I'm trying to list these choices as a kind of inventory of options that may help you as you think about your own work and life. The first one I've already talked about, having an open, consistent and resilient Christian identity. That is a choice that underpins not being driven in life. Secondly, a low debt lifestyle, and this may be one that's much more difficult, but Tony Blair said before he was elected, we enjoy 1,000 material advantages over any previous generation, and yet we suffer a depth of insecurity and spiritual doubt they never knew. And debt is a huge problem in our society. I don't know how much of an issue it is in the military, but certainly across the country, consumer debt is a major issue. Here's a Banksy cartoon, the sale ends today, and they're all worshipping that. And I've got a short video clip about this. Yeah, I put these slides together before all the economic woes that we had recently. So debt is a big issue, and you know, the Bible says let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. To have a low debt lifestyle stops you from having a hard landing later on in life, and it enables you to make changes where otherwise you perhaps couldn't if you're up to here in mortgage debt. Now, I know that there are some people's life situation in which it's all very well to hear somebody who has had the income I've had talk about being low debt. You know, that's no joke for a lot of people. There are single mothers out there for whom debt is almost the only way they can survive, for example. If you're in that situation, then I suggest you talk to Christians Against Poverty. You may not be in poverty, but Christians Against Poverty is an excellent charity that helps people negotiate with creditors, manage their finances, and get out of debt. And they have a very high track record success rate of helping even quite low-income families get out of debt. So these are some of the decisions that you have to face up to if you're thinking about having a low-debt lifestyle. You have to face up to the money issue. A lot of people try and bury it, actually. You have to ask for advice about it, and I can't think of a better place than CAP. Choosing a budget where your expenditure doesn't equal your exceed your income. What sort of house, mortgage, car you drive, what sort of schooling, healthcare you choose, what sort of job you're doing. So I just offer that really as a choice that I think really affects a lot of people and needs drawing attention to. Thirdly, effective rhythms and working patterns. And I don't know if you know that everything that is healthy is in rhythm. You know, your heart beats in rhythm, You breathe in rhythms, you eat in rhythms, you sleep in rhythms. If you obey the fourth commandment, you take a day off every week in a rhythm. Everything that's healthy is in a rhythm. If your ECG is flat, you're in trouble. And when you think about the way the world works, the world is not in that kind of rhythm. The world is always on, through mobiles, through the internet, maybe even through your commanding officer, I don't know. But there's like a flat line of input going on from the world, from the media, and from every other kind of source of noise. If we don't protect ourselves against that and force ourselves to adopt healthy rhythms, we end up suffering. Our well-being, our health starts to suffer. So having a structure in your life where you really force yourself to get into healthy rhythms is really important. 7 day working often ends up with periods of illness, which in a way are like Sabbaths in arrears because, you know, you've been building up the need for that rest that you haven't taken. So that's the first thing. Research has shown actually that people who take a short break for lunch are actually more productive in the afternoon than the people who sit at their desk and eat while they're typing, you know, stuff like that. And then when it comes to working patterns, what should I do about this microphone? Do you want me to keep going with this? Or yeah, okay. There's this issue of plan, do, review. Now, plan, do, review is the way that God works. You know, he plans something, then he does it, and then he reviews it. You look at Genesis, for example. Take creation. God the Father planned creation. God the Son did creation. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. God the Holy Spirit reviewed creation, breathed life, and yes, it was good. You see that pattern developing in the Bible. And I find that people tend to vary which of these three elements they miss out. You know, some people are great planners and they don't do much. Or they're great doers and they don't plan much. Or they don't review their work. And then I find other people who are like auditors who spend their life reviewing work and get fed up because they'd like to do their own work. So I think that this plan, do, review thing is really quite significant. I used to have back-to-back meetings when I was at Hewlett-Packard, starting at maybe 8 a.m., running through to 6 o'clock at night, one-hour meetings with people, because as a senior manager, you get things done through other people. Then I read about this, and I changed it. I started leaving gaps in between these meetings, apparently unproductive gaps. But what happened was that at the end of those meetings, I would write up the notes, I'd follow up the actions, I'd plan for the next meeting, and I ended up doing fewer meetings and becoming more effective. Because that's the way that God's wired us to work. Okay? So plan, do, review makes a big difference. I've already talked about this, how much you can fit in your jar. That's part of your effective rhythm and working practices, planning your eggs in first. And then there's this, time out to reflect and pray. I talked about that a little bit, but this is really important, especially in this 24/7 world that we live in. You know, what is the greatest casualty of a busy life? Answer, intimacy with God. Intimacy with God is what gets missed. What is the missing quality of a busy life? Intimate relationships and quiet conviction. You know, that's where you develop a sense of real conviction about things, when you're quiet before God. Be still and know that I am God, he says. There's a great book which I've got a copy of somewhere. I think I put a few books of interest on the back table. Soulfulness, you can hardly see that. Soulfulness by Brian Draper is a great book. It takes what is the current trend towards mindfulness, which is perhaps a discipline that is not especially religious in any one sense, but it's a current vogue, and he Christianizes it and talks about soulfulness, and I found that a very helpful book. There's a picture of God touching the finger of Adam on the Sistine Chapel. You know, just those moments where you can connect with God are so important. When you look at the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and so on. It then says in the second half, talk about these commands when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and your gates. And when you think about it, you can apply that kind of thinking, you know, think about God as you go through your day in these ways. So the journey in. I know a guy who, as he drives into work, when he passes a certain tree, and it triggers in his mind, yeah, I'm going to pray, you know, with his eyes open. He prays, it's just a God moment, okay? The journey in. The screensaver. Now, some people have appallingly twee screensavers, but there may be something on your screensaver that just reminds you of God. The progress bar, while you're waiting for the internet and the Wi-Fi to connect and that bar is filling up. I know one bloke who prays to be filled with the Holy Spirit, you know, he kind of uses that as a prompt for that. Your desk accessories, I don't mean cringeware that you buy from the local tack shop, you know, but just something. One bloke I know has got a bowl of potpourri on his desk, just a small bowl of potpourri. And when he sees that, he remembers, yeah, we are the fragrance of Christ. Just triggers something in his mind. The mobile phone. Does your mobile phone play Praise My Soul, the King of Heaven? If it does, change it. No. But there may be something on your mobile that reminds you of God. Your to-do list. Is prayer on your to-do list? What happens when somebody rings you or knocks on the door? Is there a connection moment, opportunity there? What happens when you go to the toilet? You know, you can talk to God in the toilet. And you can talk to God on the journey out. Not the journey out of the toilet. The journey out of work, you know. So just these moments, these touch points during the day are a bit like that original command in the Old Testament of tying the commands on you and talking about them. It's this sense of living in the presence of God. So the rhythm of relating to God is seasonal, it's monthly, it's weekly, it's daily, and it's moment by moment. The more you can build that in as a kind of spiritual practice, a spiritual pattern, a discipline, the more you will find that you are living and working in the presence of God and experiencing a greater sense of integration. Let me come on now to fifth choice, personal values and mission statement. I said I'd written down my personal values. I did that first of all in 1997. Here are my personal values and commitment statement. It goes on to two pages. First one is, following the Lord Jesus Christ as Lord of my life, to his priorities for my time, talents and treasure, I will endeavour to hear God's voice through the word and prayer and act in obedience. And I guess you could say that was probably true for any Christian. But I wrote that down. Second commitment, Helen, as her faithful husband, developing our marriage. Thirdly, creating with Helen a home where people experience God's love. We agreed that. Starting with our children, encouraging believers to live fruitful and fulfilled lives. Communicating God's word graciously and truthfully. Living in community, friendship and accountability with other people. And knowing Christ as my personal life goal. And rejecting positions, possessions and pleasures as my goals in life. Now doesn't that sound wonderful? It sounds absolutely, I should be the Pope, you know. The fact is, I am failing to a greater or lesser extent on pretty well all of those personal values and commitment statement. Okay, I'm not standing up here saying this is how I'm living. It's how I'm trying to live. The fact that I've written these things down is a plumb line for me. And it's a plumb line that is public, which is a bit embarrassing sometimes because I know there's a gap between who I am and who I aspire to be. But on the other hand, in key moments when key decisions have to be made, that helps, you know, that I've written it down, that I know what I'm about, and I know that this is the way I want to live. So try that exercise. It'll be different for you in certain details, but try writing down some personal values and commitments. And then there's the issue of developing focus in your life. You know that it says in Ephesians 2:8, God has prepared in advance good works for us to do. A lot of people have this mentality, if you get these self-help books, where you dream your dream and then you try to walk into your dream, you know. Actually, our task as Christians is to discover God's dream and then to walk into that. That's where we develop our focus. And you can ask yourself some questions about this. What brings you to life? What energizes me? I mean, for me, doing this energizes me. This is part of who I am, okay? When do I feel fully alive? What is it I'm doing when I feel fully alive? Bit of a clue, okay? What do I long for? What do I hunger and thirst for? What matters to me? What am I fighting for? What am I passionate about? What's in the gut, you know? Who is the real me? And if I asked other people who know me well, what would they say? What answer would they give to these questions? This is a self-analysis that we should try to do under the guidance of the Holy Spirit in order to get closer to the works that God has put in advance for you to do.
A cowboy leads a different kind of life when there were cowboys. But Don Brady still means something to me, though. A couple of days, we'll move this herd across the river, ride through the valley. Wow. There's nothing like bringing in a herd.
See, now that's great. Your life makes sense to you. What's so funny?
You city folk, you worry about all that shit.
Shit? Yeah. My wife basically told me she doesn't want me around.
Is she ready?
I'm just saying.
How old are you? 38.
39.
Yeah. You all come up here about the same age, same problems. Spend about 50 weeks a year getting knots in your rope, and then you think 2 weeks up here is a long time for you. None of you get it. Do you know what the secret of life is?
No, what?
This.
Your finger?
One thing. Just one thing. You stick to that and everything else don't mean shit.
That's great, but what's the one thing?
I think you've got to figure out.
What's the one thing? That's what you've got to figure out. Here's my personal mission statement: to teach and inspire people to make the right choices. That's what I do. When I look back over my life, I discovered I did this as a parent, I did it as an accountant, I did it as an executive coach, I did it as a manager, I'm doing it now. This is how God uses me, in one of the key ways, to inspire people to make the right choices. Took a while to figure that out, but I wonder what your personal mission statement might be. And it's not something specific to your job, it's something that's bigger than your job, it's something that permeates who you are in life. The marks of a calling are that it's consistent with God's purposes, it has an inner conviction and desire to do it, it's talent, it's your talent, your gifting, it's enjoyable, it energizes you, and it's confirmed by other people. It's not just your own idea, it's the wider body of Christ who say, yeah, that is you. We read that in the Bible, don't we? For example, and all Israel attested that Samuel was a prophet of the Lord. You know, they said, yeah, that is him. So what do people say about you? Have you asked people about that? Have you done that kind of thinking? Because this is where, for example, if you're coming up to a career change, knowing more about yourself, knowing more about who you really are, helps you make the right choices, or at least avoid the wrong ones. Jesus said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. A couple of books that could help you. There are a couple of display copies. The Path by Laurie Beth Jones, and Ken Costa's written a book called Know Your Why. These are books that are quite helpful as you think through this issue of your own calling and personal mission. Number six. Finally, it's very quick, but knowing your non-negotiables. Now, I don't know how relevant this is to you, but if you change your job or your assignment, you always change one of three things. You either change who you work for, what you do, or where and when you work. Okay? One of those three things has to change. Who you work for, what you do, or when and where you work. Or maybe more than one changes. And I think of these things like this is interesting. 70% of people leave their managers, by the way, not their jobs. That's proved by Gallup research. I'll come back to that. Here we go. You either change your organisation, who you work for, what you do, your function, or where and where you work, your geography and availability. And I think of these like these three orthogonal axes. And in order to keep employable in today's economy, and probably even in today's military, you have to be flexible. You have to be willing to try different things. And in the process of being flexible, it helps to think about which of these three axes do I really want to fix and which can I let float. So, for example, in my career, when I moved from Walls Ice Cream to Hewlett Packard, I moved from Gloucestershire to Berkshire. So I moved geographically, but I stayed an accountant. Okay. Once I was in Hewlett-Packard, I didn't want to move geographically. I refused that Geneva relocation, and I changed what I did. I changed from being an accountant to being a commercial manager, then to being a general manager, and you know, eventually I ended up in human resources. So there was a large increase in the number of things I knew nothing about. so, you know, that was a different kind of flexibility within one organisation. I talked to one guy who said, I always want to be an accountant. I felt very sorry for him. But I said, well, in which case, if you're going to fix that function axis, then you're going to have to let the other two float. Now he's an accountant on the west coast of America. He let that particular axis float. So it's just an interesting framework to think about. Now, you, as part of the services, you know, you're probably stuck in one organisation, although you can move between the services. But are you going to stay the same as what you do all the time and let the geography float? Or are you going to stick in one geography and change what you do? It's worth thinking about. So those are, you know, just a thought about non-negotiables in life, what really matters to you. And the final one is voluntary accountability partners. And we already talked about that earlier. That is the seventh good choice in my list. Having somebody with whom you can share and pray and, you know, do life with effectively. So, just to summarise, for the Christian, an integrated life means having our identity, our purpose and our choices all centred in Christ. We are first and foremost children of God. That is who we are. Our life purpose as Christians is part of the purpose of God in the world. And the values we have as children of God, seeking to follow the will of God, the values on which we base our choices, should reflect the identity and the purpose under God that we have. Now, of course, nobody's perfect this side of heaven, and there'll always be tension in life and a fallen world to live in. So living an integrated life is not easy, but having a framework to think about it helps a lot to make the right choices. So now's a chance before lunch just to think about your own action plan. Take out that piece of paper. Down the left-hand side, you will find the topics that I've talked about, the choices that I've identified. Anybody not got one? There's one spare over there. This is the second bit of paper. If you haven't got the second bit of paper, I don't know, maybe we've run out. Yeah, a couple there, another one there. There you go, I'll take this one. Thank you. That's great. So down the left-hand side, you'll see, you know, things like low-debt lifestyle, open Christian identity, and so on. Just run down there and put a tick against any one of those things that you feel, yeah, that resonates with me at the moment. That's something I would like to do. And then for the items that you've ticked, then think to yourself, okay, well, what am I going to do about that? Whose help do I need, and when might I do that? So you're just putting together a little personal action plan here that you can take away and remember the key thing that affected you today before you lose it all over lunch. Okay, I'll give you a few minutes to fill that in, and then I think we're done. Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there. You can carry on at your leisure over lunch. This evening we're going to be talking about something completely different, about improving relationships. But I hope that today you've been able to take at least one or two golden nuggets out of this that could help your life. Thanks very much. Over to you, Nicola.
Thank you.